Hello and welcome to In the News. I'm Chris. This is Rick Anderson, and today I'll be reading selected stories from the May 29th, 2024 edition of the New York Times Science section. The first selection says, Rivers of lava on Venus reveal a volcanically active planet. New software lets scientists re-examine old radar images, providing some of the strongest evidence yet that volcanoes continue to reshape the hellish planet. The story is by Robin George Andrews. Witnessing the blood-red fires of a volcanic eruption on Earth is memorable, but to see molten rock bleed out of a volcano on a different planet would be extraordinary. That is close to what scientists have spotted on Venus. Two vast, sinuous lava flows oozing. After you see something like this, the first reaction is, wow, said David Sulcanese, a doctoral student at the University of D'Annunzio in Pescara, Italy, and an author of a study reporting the discovery in the journal Nature Astronomy. Earth and Venus were forged at the same time. Both are made of the same primeval matter, and both are the same age and size. So why is Earth a paradise overflowing with water and life, while Venus is a scorched hellscape with acidic skies? Volcanic eruptions tinker with planetary atmospheres. One theory holds that, eons ago, several apocalyptic eruptions set off a runaway greenhouse effect on Venus, turning it from a temperate, waterlogged world into an arid desert of burned glass. To better understand its volcanism, scientists hoped to catch a Venusian eruption in the act. But although the planet is known to be smothered in volcanoes, an opaque atmosphere has prevented anyone from seeing an eruption the way spacecraft have spotted them on Io, the hypervolcanic moon of Jupiter. In the 1990s, NASA's spacecraft Magellan used cloud-penetrating radar to survey most of the planet. But back then, the relatively low-resolution images made spotting fresh molten rock a troublesome task. By using modern software to peruse Magellan's data, scientists now found two unambiguous lava flows, one tripping down the flank of Sif Mons, a broad shield volcano, and another winding its way down a western part of Niobe Planitia, a flat plain pockmarked with numerous volcanic mountains. Many planetary scientists reckoned Venus was effervescing with eruptions. But it's one thing to strongly suspect it, and quite another to know it, said Paul Byrne, a planetary scientist at Washington University in St. Louis, who was not part of the new study. Venus lacks the plate tectonics of Earth, but its similarly rocky constitution and comparable size suggests that something must still be cooking inside the sun's second planet, and it should be volcanically active. There is indirect supporting evidence. Volcanic gases linger in Venus's skies, and the way that parts of the planet glow suggests they were painted over by lava in the recent geological past. Direct evidence of volcanic fury finally and surprisingly emerged in 2023. When researchers caught sight of a volcanic vent doubling in size and possibly filling with lava in old Magellan data. Other scientists still yearned for signs of an unequivocal lava flow, an almost literal smoking gun. Mr. Sulcanese granted their wish. He found bright, river-like patches on Sif Mons and Niobe Planitia in later Magellan survey images that weren't present in earlier data. After carefully ruling out other possibilities, including landslides, his team concluded that lava was the only reasonable explanation. Magellan is the gift that keeps on giving, said Stephen Kane, a planetary astrophysicist at the University of California, Riverside, who also was not involved with the new study. Both lava flows are comparable in size to the output of the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii during its 3-month paroxysm in 2018. And using these two eruptions, the study's authors estimate that there is considerably more eruptive activity than previously assumed, and that it's happening elsewhere on the planet in the present day. Venus is active, said Giuseppe Mitri, an astronomer also at the Università d'Annunzio and an author of the study. More important, volcanically speaking, Venus is Earth-like, said Anna Gulcher, a planetary scientist at the California Institute of Technology, who was not involved with the work. The result also complicates the tentative detection of phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. Phosphine is a substance that is usually associated on Earth with living things, but other explanations for its possible presence on Venus couldn't be ruled out. Volcanic activity can also make phosphine, but rebuttals to that idea have suggested that Venus simply doesn't have sufficient volcanism to make it. Well, apparently there is, Dr. Kane said. The only way to find answers on phosphine, Venus's volcanic cadence, its cataclysmic transformation, is to revisit the planet. Fortunately, a fleet of new spacecraft is set to do just that in the 2030s. While we wait, Magellan's memories will continue to offer unexpected gifts. We can start to think of Venus as a living, breathing world, Dr. Burns said. And we turn now to another story, which begins with Ancient Skull with Brain Cancer Preserves Clues to Egyptian Medicine. Cuts in the cranium, which is more than 4,000 years old, hint that people in the ancient civilization attempted to create a scourge that persists today. The story is by Jordan Pearson. Fluctuating disease rates, innovative treatments, and talk of moonshots in the White House may make cancer seem like a modern scourge. But a new discovery highlights how humans dealt with the illness and hunted for cures as far back as the time of the ancient Egyptians. Scientists led by Edgard Camaros, a paleopathologist at the University of Santiago de Compostela in Spain, were studying an approximately 4,600-year-old Egyptian skull when they found signs of brain cancer and its treatment. There was an uncomfortable silence in the room because we knew what we had just discovered, Dr. Camaros said. Using a microscope, he and Tatiana Tondini of the University of Tübingen in Germany and Albert Isidro of the University Hospital Sagrat Cor in Spain, the study's other authors, found cut marks around the skull's edges surrounding dozens of lesions that earlier researchers had linked to metastasized brain cancer. The shape of the cuts indicated that they would have been made with a metal tool. This discovery, reported in a study published recently in the journal Frontiers in Medicine, suggests that ancient Egyptians studied brain cancer using surgery. If the cuts were made while the person was alive, they may have even attempted to treat it. The new discovery not only expands scientific knowledge of Egyptian medicine, it may also push back the timeline of humanity's documented attempts to treat cancer by up to 1,000 years. Cancer has bedeviled humans for as long as we have existed, and even afflicted life on Earth long before. Cancer is as old as time, Dr. Camaros said. Even dinosaurs suffered from cancer. Paleopathologists like Dr. Camaros study the evolution of a disease as well as attempts to understand or treat it. For example, we know that humans in prehistory were afflicted with cancers that no longer exist. He and his colleagues hope that unraveling cancer's shifting nature over millenniums may reveal information that can help design treatments for today. While cancer was probably not well understood, medicine in Egypt was advanced compared to much of the ancient world. An Egyptian document called the Edwin Smith Papyrus, which was written roughly 3,600 years ago, refers to what some researchers believe is a cancer case. The text describes a grave disease for which there is no treatment. People in ancient Egypt also operated on skulls in other ways. Dr. Comoros' team also reports in the study that they found evidence of successful treatment for a traumatic injury on another cranium, this one 2,600 years old. KCL Kirkpatrick, a bioarchaeologist and postdoctoral researcher at the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany, said the new paper presents the first physical evidence of possible cancer treatment by ancient Egyptians. And by documenting additional ancient historical evidence of the disease, Dr. Kilpatrick said the story has another benefit. It can also remind us that cancer is not a modern disease, she said, which might help to relieve some guilt in those currently affected by cancer who are concerned about the role that their lifestyle played in its development. Just as cancer treatment was a frontier for ancient Egyptians, explorations of the deep past by modern researchers is fraught with uncertainty. The researchers say it is impossible to determine whether the skull's surgical markings were made before death, suggesting treatment, or after. Many cancers also arise in soft tissues, leaving bones unaffected. This presents a challenge for modern scientists because bones are all that typically survive in the fossil record. Despite these obstacles, Dr. Comoros said that the new discovery gave scientists a fresh perspective on what to look for. He plans to search for similar evidence in ancient sites in Kenya next. I'm sure this is just one example, he said. And we turn now to another story, which says, "Don't let a bird's feathers fool you." From sibling murder to snakes for breakfast, birds' lives may be darker than you imagine. This story is by James Gorman. I saw a couple of crows dining on roadkill the other day as I was driving by and wondered, does this count as bird watching? I think it should. I know that birding is having a moment. It was something you could do outside of catching COVID at the height of the pandemic. And it offers the opportunity for being close to nature and spending money on fancy binoculars at the same time, a winning combination for 45 million Americans. I'm in favor of this trend. I love birds. I have watched them, written about them, and tried to remember their names and field marks. I even lived with one for a while. It was a small captive bred parrot, a sun conure, that was supposed to be my daughter's pet. But as a freelance writer, I was home all day long while she was at school, and the bird really, really wanted company. I'm not an expert birder. I don't have a life list, and I can't tell one juvenile gull from another. But I know never to say seagull. Real birders will have your head. And I don't just watch the birds that come to the feeder, or land on a plate while I'm having lunch at an outdoor table. At the same time, my wife and I, no, I have gone to Nebraska rising before dawn to watch male greater prairie chickens stomp and boom and promenade to get the attention of female greater prairie chickens. On the same trip, my wife and I slept in a tiny concrete blind on the Platte River with overnight temperatures in the 30s and a bucket for a bathroom, so that we could see flocks of mating sandhill cranes at dusk and dawn. Still, I would like us all to look beyond the painted buntings to the carrot-eating, sibling-killing, snake-eating side of our feathered friends. They are not just pretty bundles of plumage, nor are they always that friendly. You've probably heard of obligates, sublicide, unless you hang out with behavioral ecologists. Loosely translated, it means death to the weak. Kookaburras do it, boobies do it, even egrets and skuas do it. Basically, the parents lay an insurance egg, so they have an heir and a spare. Then the bigger, tougher chick kills the weaker one. Facultative suicide is even more common. That's death to the weak. I saw the murdering in progress once. I was on a cruise to Antarctica to write a coffee table book about penguins. During one of the naturalist-led walks through a penguin colony, we watched one skua chick mercilessly, and I mean mercilessly, attack a smaller chick, while the parents looked the other way. I guess they were thinking, well, birds will be birds. Time to go kill and eat a penguin baby. I once had a staring match with a raven in Yellowstone Park. The raven, which I remember as being the size of a velociraptor, was pecking away at a carcass as I approached. At the time, I was writing a book about dinosaurs, and I was entranced by the fact that birds are the descendants of dinosaurs. I stared at the raven. The raven stared back. I moved closer. The raven didn't budge. I backed off, humming that Kenny Rogers song about the gambler. You gotta know when to hold 'em. I told myself, well, you've got to know when to hold 'em. And then I told myself that the reason for my retreat was that it was ethically wrong and illegal to disturb wildlife in the park. I had another daring encounter, this time with a bald eagle, in the marshy reaches of southern New Jersey on the Delaware Bay. I was writing a profile of Peter Dunn, who founded the World Series of Birding and has numerous books on birds. He spotted the eagle a football field away. I looked at it through a spotting scope and binoculars. The eagle looked back. Given the eyesight of eagles, I'm pretty sure it saw me, its gaze unwavering. I think it was sizing me up, noting that I was too big to eat, and wondering what a newbie like me was doing with Peter Dunn. There are stairs that don't give an inch. Ka'a, in the Jungle Book, ravens, birds of prey, and the minds behind those stairs are deeply different from our own. Don't take my word for it. Reading H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, particularly the sections where the goshawk that she is trying to tame clenches its talons in hungry anticipation when it hears a human baby cry just outside the window. There are really dinosaurs under those beautiful feathers, and the bird that most looks like a dinosaur to me, so much that it sends me back to the Cretaceous period in my mind, is the great blue heron. I've spent a lot of time watching herons stalk fish in ponds and on riverbanks. They move slowly, haltingly, on improbable stick legs, almost as if they were old-tech animatronic construction. Then they strike with a blurringly fast stab of their snake-like neck and pickaxe bill and swallow you. I mean the minnow, whole. They don't eat only minnows. From a boardwalk in Everglades National Park, I once witnessed a battle between a great blue heron and a snake that I couldn't identify. The heron had caught the snake and was trying to eat it. The snake wasn't dead and kept wrapping itself around the bird's beak. The heron would drop the snake and stab it again with its beak. The snake, not seriously wounded, would again wrap itself tightly around the heron's beak. This happened several times over. I left after about 15 minutes with the two creatures in a stalemate that showed no signs of resolving. I did feel a oneness with nature while watching this, but it wasn't what I was looking for. And that's what you may find watching birds. If you spend some time at it and pay attention, by all means watch birds. Don't just identify them. Study them, and not just the pretty ones in their best moments. Absorb their alien presence. You'll be richer for it. And now for another exciting story that says the textbooks were wrong about how your tongue works. The perception of taste is remarkably complex, not only for the tongue, but in organs throughout the body. This story is by Joanne Silberner. Think a minute about those little bumps on your tongue. You probably saw a diagram of those taste bud arrangements once in a biology textbook. Sweet sensors at the tip, salty on either side, sour behind them, bitter in the back. But the idea that specific tastes are confined to certain areas of the tongue is a myth that persists in the collective consciousness despite decades of research debunking it, according to a review published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. Also wrong, the notion that taste is limited to the mouth. The old diagram, which has been used in many textbooks over the years, originated in a study published by David Honig, a German scientist, in 1901. But the scientist was not suggesting that various tastes are segregated on the tongue. He was actually measuring the sensitivity of different areas, said Paul Breslin, a researcher at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. What he found was that you could detect things at a lower concentration in one part relative to the other, Dr. Breslin said. The tip of the tongue, for example, is dense with sweet sensors, but contains the others as well. The MAPS mistakes are easy to confirm. If you place a lemon wedge at the tip of your tongue, it'll taste sour. And if you put a bit of honey toward the side, it still will be sweet. The perception of taste is a remarkably complex process, starting from that first encounter with the tongue. Taste cells have a variety of sensors that signal the brain when they encounter nutrients or toxin. For some tastes, tiny pores in cell membranes let taste chemicals in. Such taste receptors aren't limited to the tongue. They are also found in the gastrointestinal tract, liver, pancreas, fat cells, brain, muscle cells, thyroid, and lungs. We don't generally think of these organs as tasting anything, but they use receptors to pick up the presence of various molecules and metabolize them, said Diego Bahorques, a self-described gut-brain neuroscientist at Duke University. For example, when the gut notices sugar in food, it tells the brain to alert other organs to get ready for digestion. Dr. Breslin likens the system to an airport preparing for a plane landing. Think about if a plane landed at an airport terminal that wasn't ready, he said. No one would be prepared to guide the plane to the gate, clean it up, or unload luggage. Taste, he said, gets things ready. It wakes up the stomach, stimulates salivation, and sends a little insulin into the blood, which in turn transports sugars into the cells. Ivan Pavlov, a Russian physiologist who won a Nobel Prize for his studies on digestion in 1904, showed that lumps of meat placed directly into a hole on the dog's stomach would not be digested unless he dusted the dog's tongue with some dried meat powder to start things off. Dr. Bohorquez was inspired to hunt for a gut-brain connection 2 decades ago when he was in graduate school, and a friend who had undergone bariatric surgery asked him why she no longer hated sunny-side-up eggs. Dr. Bohorquez thought that perhaps the taste receptors in her now diminished gut were sensing that she wasn't receiving enough nutrients and began signaling to her brain that, hey, eating runny egg yolks would be a good idea now. He and his colleagues found a connection in the lab. Taste receptor-bearing cells in the gut, which he called neuropods, make direct contact with nerve cells that let the brain know a nutrient is in the gut. Taste perception is more complex than just taste buds, Dr. Bohorquez said. Newer studies are not only making the matter more complex. Umami, a savory taste found in foods like fish sauce and ketchup, began to be accepted as the fifth category of taste by researchers in the late 1980s and early 1990s, nearly 80 years after it was proposed by Kikunae Ikeda, a Japanese chemist. More than 2,100 research papers about umami are now listed by the National Library of Medicine. Several years ago, an Australian research team suggested that there might be a special taste receptor for fat. Dr. Breslin and his others are studying how taste receptor cells identify fat, information that could be useful in figuring out why some people overeat. And in our final story, shortened no doubt, you'll be disappointed to know that Apex, the largest Stegosaurus fossil ever found, heads to auction. The specimen found by paleontologist Jason Cooper could be auctioned for millions of dollars by Sotheby's. Story is by Asher Elbing. In May 2022, Jason Cooper, a commercial paleontologist, went for a walk around his property near the aptly named Colorado town of Dinosaur with a friend and found a bit of femur protruding from some rock. That femur led to a Stegosaurus fossil, among the largest and most complete ever found, which was subsequently named Apex. In July, the Sotheby's auction house will sell Apex at auction for an estimated value of $4 million-$6 million, making the skeleton perhaps the latest flashpoint in a long-running debate about private fossil trade. Dinosaur fossils have fetched escalating prices at auction houses since 1997, when Sotheby's sold Sue, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, to the Field Museum in Chicago for $8.36 million. In 2020, Stan, the other largely complete T-Rex skeleton, sold at Christie's for $31.8 million. Such pricing has raised serious concerns among academic paleontologists, said Stuart Semita, Vice President of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. Many of them have watched fossils that may unlock scientific mysteries get steered into the hands of wealthy private collectors rather than toward research institutions in recent decades. Mr. Cooper and his colleagues unearthed the Sotheby's-bound Stegosaurus in 2023. Digs on his property have yielded a number of Jurassic-period dinosaurs, several of which Mr. Cooper donated to institutions like Brigham Young University Museum of Paleontology in Provo, Utah, and the Frost Museum of Science in Miami. Mr. Cooper described the Apex Stegosaurus as a unique and scientifically important specimen. Skeletons, even partial ones of the plate-backed spice-tailed herbivore, are rare. The skeletal mount contains material from about 70% of the animal's bones. At 11 feet tall and over 20 feet long, Apex is double the size of Sophie, the most intact Stegosaurus specimen known, and has unusual proportion, remarkably long legs, and square bottom plates. The specimen was also discovered with skin impressions, possibly from the neck, which will be offered as part of the sale. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson reading selected stories from the New York Times Science section as of May 29th, 2024. Hope you enjoyed the readings. Hey, let's do this again next week.